This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart.
No, it's happening. It's happening right now. So let's see how this one goes.
In a neighborhood north of Bangkok, a passenger train is about to roll right through a densely crowded street market.
It's just inches away from the people and their shops and all of that, and both the train and the people are paying little attention to each other. Like if a big Greyhound bus went through your office and you sort of stepped aside and, you know, yeah, whatever.
Stuart Brand, who shared this story with us, says this kind of thing happens all the time in compact communities.
But as the end of the train goes by, suddenly the track fills up with people and with awnings and with shops, and within 15 seconds of the train having passed by, it's as if there were no train tracks, as if there was no train. So the community just basically heals up over this seemingly huge event that just passed through. It's astonishing how quick and how thoroughly it happens. And you realize the resourcefulness of these folks and the energy and the focus on, in this case, making their market happen is formidable. And they will step briefly out of the way of a huge train, but only very briefly.
Cities are places where man-made miracles like this happen every day. In recent years, TED speakers have made the case that cities represent humanity's best hope for a sustainable future. If our planet is to house a projected 9 or 10 billion people much sooner than one might expect, the only way to do this is for humans to live together in close quarters. The theory is, in cities, creativity and opportunity rise, while family size and carbon footprint fall. Several TED speakers make the case that you can see this most intensely in the areas where humanity is urbanizing most rapidly, the world's slums. Now, you might think of slums as deadly, stressful, unstable places, but perhaps that's not the only story. Here's Stuart Brand.
The dominant demographic event of our time is the screamingly rapid urbanization that we have going on. By mid-century, we'll be about 80% urban, and that's mostly in the developing world where that's happening. It's interesting, because history is driven to a large degree by the size of cities. The developing world now has all of the biggest cities, and they are developing 3 times faster than the developed countries, and 9 times bigger. It's qualitatively different. They're the drivers of history, as we see by looking at history. In other words, the rise of the West, dramatic as it was, is over. The aggregate numbers are absolutely overwhelming. 1.3 million people a week coming to town, decade after decade. What's really going on? Well, what's going on is the villages of the world are emptying out. Subsistence farming is drying up, basically. People are following opportunity into town. I used to have a very romantic idea about villages, and it's because I never lived in one. Because in town, they see action, they see opportunity, they see a cash economy that they were not able to participate in back in the subsistence farm.
Stuart Brand, welcome to the TED Radio Hour.
Well, thank you for having me.
Stuart, I want to follow up on something that you said at the beginning of your talk, that history is driven to a large degree by the size of cities. They are the drivers of history. Can you explain that a bit more?
Cities are the place where a lot of change happens. Not just for individuals, but for whole societies. And so historians have caught on that if you want to understand any particular era or any particular region of the world, look at what's going on in the largest cities at that time or in those places, and then you'll get a good idea of where the driving forces of change are playing out. And so in the West, we've gotten used to thinking of history is driven by what goes on in London and Paris and New York. And that was the case about 100 years ago, but those are no longer the largest cities in the world. Now the largest cities are places like Lagos and Mumbai and Sao Paulo, and that's where major change is happening.
As you go around these places, there's plenty of aesthetics. There's plenty going on. They're poor, but they're intensely urban. It is not the case that slums undermine prosperity, not the working slums. They help create prosperity. So in a town like Mumbai, which is half slums, it's 1/6 of the GDP of India. Social capital in the slums is at its most urban and dense. These people are valuable as a group, and that's how they work. There's a lot of people who get control of these poor people. There's terrible things. We've got to fix their housing. It used to be we've got to get them phone service. Now they're showing us how to do phone service. Famine mostly is a rural event now. There are things they care about. And this is where we can help, and the nations they're in can help, and they are helping each other solve these issues. And you go to a nice, dense place like the slum in Mumbai, and you can ask, okay, what's going on there? And the answer is everything. This is better than the mall. It's much denser, it's much more interactive, and the scale is terrific. The main event is these are not people crushed by poverty. These are people busy getting out of poverty just as fast as they can. They're helping each other do it.
Stuart, one example that you offer as a reason that cities have opportunity and might attract talent is really very simple. It's what someone can earn, how much they can earn in a city. But for people who are listening to this and say, money's not an incentive in my world. This is not what I think of when I think of a reason to do something. What else might a city offer someone?
Well, the main thing it offers really is liberation for women. Typically in the villages, there's very traditional mores, and a young woman marries some guy, and she's now under the thumb of him, of the traditions, of the culture, and of whoever the senior character in the family is, and basically she works for them. Once she gets into town, she can get rid of the guy if he's a jerk. She's not under the thumb of his mother. She's got the ability to start a community organization or even a business of her own, get together with the other women, do various collaborative things with loans, get some education for the kids, get decent medical care for herself and for the kids. And the women are the major driving force in the urbanization in the developing world right now.
That's so interesting, because you wonder about the ability to just shift mentally, emotionally, culturally from the way you would live perhaps on the farm as opposed to you live next to a gigantic city like in Nairobi.
I think one of the great human stories that wants to be told these decades is what it is like for somebody to uproot like that and haul off and change their situation, their family life, their whole career, their perspective on everything, their access to everything totally in the course of a couple of weeks, moving from a village culture that has been the same for basically thousands of years and move into a town where life is different, you know, one week after another. What's that like to make that change? Well, the one thing we know is that it must be pretty attractive because billions of people are doing it. And what is that story? That's the story we'd love to know more about.
There's all kinds of activity. In Dabrodi, the slum performs not only a lot of services for itself, but enormous services for the city at large. And one of the main events are these ad hoc schools. The parents pool their money, hire some local teachers, do a private, tiny, unofficial school. Education is more possible in the cities, and that changes the world. This is what makes cities so green in the developing world, because people leave the poverty trap and the ecological disaster of subsistence farms and head to town. When they're gone, the natural environment starts to come back very rapidly, and those who remain in the village can shift over to cash crops to send food to the new growing markets in town. So if you want to save a village, you do it with a good road, with a good cell phone connection, and ideally some grid electrical power. So the event is, we're a city planet. That just happened, more than half. The numbers are considerable. 1 billion live in the squatter cities now, another 1 billion is expected. That's more than 1/6 of humanity living a certain way. And that will determine a lot of how we function. Thank you.
Stuart, finally, what are some of the possible outcomes of integrating these somewhat informal communities, although they have their own ways of working, integrating them into the larger established cities?
I think one of the things we'll be doing over the next couple decades is learning what parts of these informal cities are actually rather wonderful. Many of the problems have to do with the great densities, but the density itself is pretty interesting. So these markets, these market lanes that you go along, and every service in the world you can imagine is offered in just a few hundred feet. That kind of density may actually be something that people realize is itself something worth keeping. Likewise, the amount of space that people live in. A little bit of privacy goes a long way. And the idea of having huge flats as the only way to live in a city is probably not accurate. You have a lot of people living in a small space. So long as they have this kind of street life, lane access to one another, the life of the community is there to be enjoyed and participated in and earned from. So I bet that some of the ideas that have been playing out in the informal towns last because people don't want to give them up. On the other hand, gradually these things change over time and Paris stops being a huge slum and becomes Paris. These places, the Lagoses and the Mumbais and the Sao Paulos and the Jakartas will become upstanding cities, not only with high rises downtown, but with the equivalent of suburbs, which hopefully won't be completely car-type suburbs, but more mass transit-type suburbs. Those things will come to pass, and we'll look back on the era of when there were so many squatter cities as an interesting period in human history that is behind us.
Stuart Brand, thanks for joining us on the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you kindly.
Lifelong environmentalist Stuart Brand. You can find more of his TED Talks on TED.com. This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart, and today we're talking about the future of our cities. Our next guest, Robert Neuwirth, is rethinking our assumptions about community, poverty, and the shape of cities in the 21st century.
This is Rocinha, the largest and most urbanized favela in Rio de Janeiro.
Deprived areas around big cities, call them barrios, favelas, slums, or shantytowns, are super concentrations of urban poverty.
That's Kibera, the largest squatter community in Nairobi.
Neuwirth is a journalist who spent 2 years living in villages on the outskirts of Rio, Istanbul, Mumbai, and Nairobi. In 2005, he shared some of his discoveries at TED, experiences chronicled in a book called Shadow Cities.
They are what I consider to be the cities of tomorrow, the new urban world. Now, why do I say that?
Robert Neuwirth here in our studio. Why do you say that?
Well, first of all, it's approximately 1 in 6 or 1 in 7 people on the planet are squatters living in shantytowns or self-built communities. And the trends are that rural to urban migration is going to continue, that we're going to have more and more and more people living in the cities, and no government, no developer, no Donald Trump out there is going to be able to build for people at a price that they can afford. So these communities are going to continue to grow and expand, and new communities are going to be formed. And in a very pragmatic way, these represent the urban neighborhoods of the future.
You go on to quantify it a little bit further on in your talk. Let's take a listen just so people understand the numbers.
Sure.
Here are the statistics. Today, 1 billion squatters, 1 in 6 people on the planet. 2030, 2 billion squatters, 1 in 4 people on the planet. And the estimate is that in 2050, there'll be 3 billion squatters, better than 1 in 3 people on Earth. These are the cities of the future, and we have to engage them.
So what is the consequence of not engaging these populations, specifically not engaging them in a way that recognizes them as cities?
Well, first of all, it leaves people living in really deprived conditions, because although people succeed in building the house for themselves, infrastructure is a different story. And so there are many communities around the world that have no water, no sewers, no sanitation. And that requires municipal engagement. If the municipalities would engage these communities and work with them, I'm sure we could all around the world very quickly sort out how to bring water and sewers to communities that need them, electricity as well.
This brings me to my next question, and you may have answered it in there, but I'm gonna ask anyway. There have got to be people who say to you, who just don't accept your premise, mm-hmm. that we shouldn't think about these as cities. How can you think about them if they're not, they don't have organization, they don't have governance, they don't have services, you have to have some sort of order? How do you respond to people who say that they just reject the premise that this is a city?
Well, go. When you go there, you discover that they're not disordered. We're not talking about places that are completely lawless. They form their own organizations. Every squatter community has residence associations. Every neighborhood has its informal associations of who leads it. In fact, many of the communities were built by a kind of cooperative or mutuality where 10 families will get together and build 10 homes. So this is not something that comes without structure. That's the first point. The second point is that we make the mistake of thinking that these communities are outright deprived. One of the huge surprises I had when I went to Kibera and first came into the community, this is the basically largest mud hut settlement in sub-Saharan Africa, is how much commerce there is there. The main drags are just loaded with stores, all run by the squatters themselves. There's bars, there's, you know, health clinics, there's grocery stores, there's places where you can buy just, you know, the average necessities, drug stores. So this is a tremendously thriving economy, even though each store may be worth very little. In aggregate, it's a huge amount of commerce. And people are negotiating what the rights are, let's say. So can you have a bar there and can you have a grocery store here and is it okay for a cigarette shop to be located here or a church to be located there? So there's sort of proto-zoning, if you will. So the communities are basically organizing themselves. And that says to me that they are communities and they are creating structures that we can work with and that are adaptable to working in partnership with the city.
How long did you live in each community?
3 to 4 months in each community.
How did they differ? Or let me ask it a different way. What's the same as you went around the world in all of these communities?
Right.
Is there something that's similar?
Well, the self-reliance and the way that micro-communities have been created. People have to rely on their neighbors. So there is a tremendous sense of community and cohesion in every one of these places, including the most materially deprived. So, for instance, the huge mud hut sprawl of Kibera and Nairobi. Not all, 500,000 or 700,000 people who live there know each other, but within each little compound that exists, folks are very communitarian and they help take care of each other.
At your TED talk, you broke with TED etiquette.
Yeah.
You called it TED etiquette. And you read from your book.
Yeah.
But it really was helpful because it mm-hmm. helped illustrate what you were talking about in the first
right.
person. So let's take a listen to that passage, and then I want to ask you a couple questions on the other side.
Mm-hmm. The hut was made of corrugated metal set on a concrete pad. It was a 10 by 10 cell. Armstrong O'Brien Jr. shared it with three other men. Armstrong and his friends had no water. They bought it from a nearby tap owner. No toilet. The families in this compound shared a single pit latrine and no sewers or sanitation. They did have electricity, but it was a legal service tapped from someone else's wires and could only power one feeble bulb. This was Southland, a small shanty community on the western side of Nairobi, Kenya. But it could have been anywhere in the city because more than half the city of Nairobi lives like this. 1.5 million people stuffed into mud or metal huts with no services, no toilets, no rights. Armstrong explained the brutal reality of their situation. They paid 1,500 shillings in rent, about $20 a month, a relatively high price for a Kenyan shantytown, and they could not afford to be late with the money. In case you owe 1 month, the landlord will come with his henchmen and bundle you out. He will confiscate your things, Armstrong said. Not 1 month, 1 day. His roommate, Hillary Kibagendi Ansomu, who was cooking ugali, the spongy white cornmeal concoction that is the staple food in the country, cut into the conversation. They called their landlord a Wabenzi, meaning that he's a person who has enough money to drive a Mercedes-Benz. Hillary served the ugali with a fry of meat and tomatoes. The sun slammed down on the thin steel roof, and we perspired as we ate. After we finished, Armstrong straightened his tie, put on a wool sports jacket, and we headed out into the glare. Outside, a mound of garbage formed the border between Southland and the adjacent legal neighborhood of Langata. It was perhaps 8 feet tall, 40 feet long, and 10 feet wide. And it was set in a wider, watery ooze. As we passed, two boys were climbing the Mount Kenya of trash. They couldn't have been more than 5 or 6 years old. They were barefoot, and with each step, their toes sank into the muck, sending hundreds of flies scattering from the rancid pile. I thought they might be playing King of the Hill, but I was wrong. Once atop the pile, one of the boys lowered his shorts, squatted, and defecated. The flies buzzed hungrily around his legs. When 20 families, 100 people or so, share a single latrine, a boy pooping on a garbage pile is perhaps no big thing. But it stood in jarring contrast to something Armstrong had said as we were eating, that he treasured the quality of life in his neighborhood. For Armstrong, Southland wasn't constrained by its material conditions. Instead, the human spirit radiated out from the metal walls and garbage heaps to offer something no legal neighborhood could. Freedom. This place is very addictive, he had said. It's a simple life, but nobody is restricting you. Nobody is controlling what you do. Once you have stayed here, you cannot go back. He meant back beyond that mountain of trash, back in the legal city of legal buildings with legal leases and legal rights. Once you have stayed here, he said, you can stay for the rest of your life.
Something struck me when I heard this. I don't have nearly the experience you do, but I've mm-hmm. been to Nairobi yeah. and been to these areas. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kids are huffing glue on the street. And I can remember a little boy reached in the car to try to get my luggage. I wasn't angry at him. I just knew he could make money somehow mm-hmm. if he got my luggage. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure accepting this is the right thing. Just on a sort of personal moral level, should I accept this as a way of life? Shouldn't I be trying to figure a way to help the situation, help him not have to steal to feed himself?
Absolutely. You should. It's a question of what the way is to help people not to steal. Now, first of all, I want to in some way quarrel with your premise, which is that not all squatters are criminals and not all squatters are sniffing glue, although some may be.
Didn't mean to suggest and that.
No, there's crime. Look, but the answer to crime is figuring out how to empower people so that they don't have to turn to crime. You can put those people in jail, but that's not a solution that's sustainable over time. I'm not talking about accepting the realities. I say in the book, there's no mud hut utopia. And people should not be without water in the 21st century. People should not be without electricity in the 21st century. People should not be without sewers. Frankly, they shouldn't have been without all those things in the 19th century, maybe, you know. The point is to just assume that these places need to be driven out of existence is not the answer. These communities exist for a reason. The question is how to empower people to grow their communities and improve their lot and get more economic opportunity so that their communities are sustainable and begin to be able to have the infrastructure that everyone should take for granted in the 21st century.
What would be the first step towards that empowerment?
It's just about engaging the community and saying, look, you're not going to be summarily evicted. We're accepting de facto your presence here, and we're going to find some ways of interacting. Or it may be a kind of payment in lieu of taxes arrangement where we'll bring the water in, and no, you're not paying property taxes but because you don't own it, but your community in some way is going to have to participate in the municipal revenue stream, and you're going to have to pay water bills mm-hmm. when you get water. These are kind of sensible approaches on how municipalities could come in and work productively with these communities.
In these communities that develop, whether they be in Rio or Istanbul, mm-hmm. do the communities develop around people who are like-minded?
Well, I mean, yes. neighborhoods of them start out that way. I mean, you know, I'm not going to – if I'm moving from the rural area to the city, I'm not just going to hook up with some other guy I never met before and trust that we're going to be able to be neighbors. So people tend to work with folks from their hometown or folks that they know from their hometown or extended families. Or so there are networks that have developed where people come together and develop trust and build.
A lot of it must be about trust.
Yeah.
Or at least about self-policing internally. Did you see that at all?
Sure. Yeah.
In what way?
People talk to each other about their informal rules about if I want to build the Rosinha example that I used, if I want to sell my laje so someone can build two stories higher on my house, well, I have to get the approval of everyone who lives around me. So I have to sit and talk with my neighbors and break bread with them and see whether they'll approve this or not. And they may have problems with it because they have a roof that gets sun that might not get sun. So, you have to work with your neighbors and you have to come to some sort of resolution and trust that that resolution is going to be accepted by everyone.
Sounds like a modern day co-op.
In a way, it is. I mean, these communities are like informal cooperatives.
You wrote this book, and then your next book, it doesn't dovetail necessarily.
It's a brand extension is what I sometimes call it.
That's an excellent way
to put
it.
From informal communities to the informal economy.
Yeah. Explain to me what your second book's about, this idea of underground economy as a power.
What I call System D, in a phrase I pirated from the French Africa and the French Caribbean. But basically, all the economic activity that flies under the radar of government and doesn't get registered and doesn't get incorporated and doesn't pay taxes, but isn't criminal activity. And so
what's an example? Just
street markets in most cities around the world, cash businesses, who knows who is reporting what and how much money they make. Mobile phone airtime in most of the developing world is sold by people at the side of the road. You don't buy monthly plans. You just buy pay-as-you-go airtime, and the airtime's sold all over the place by unlicensed merchants or motorcycle taxi drivers in the developing world. It's huge, and we're talking about a massive part of the economy. I mean, I ran the numbers that the economists and statisticians give out about this economy, and if you do the math, you come up with the fact that it's worth $10 trillion a year, small bits of exchange that in aggregate are worth $10 trillion. And that's an extraordinary thing because that would make it, if it were allied in a single political structure, the second largest economy in the world after the United States.
Can you describe what you think in 50 years from now, these cities that you describe as cities of tomorrow, what they might look like?
Well, they're going to be highly developed. With all the infrastructure that we take for granted in New York or Washington or wherever we're from. The street planning will still be a bit different because they'll have developed according to the way that they were built initially, but they'll have the street grid of a Renaissance hill town in Italy, but with the poured concrete and brick construction and all the infrastructure that we take for granted in modern day Western cities.
What will take their place if they develop into these new
entities? Well, there will be – first of all, they will become more dense because there will be some higher density housing. And so more people will be living in those communities. And then there'll be new communities that form in the outlying area of cities, which are already forming. And those will go through the same process of self-development as they gain both staying power and political connectedness.
Robert Neuwirth, thanks for coming by the studio.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
Robert Neuwirth is the author of Shadow Cities and, more recently, Stealth of Nations. You can find links to Robert's blog and find out more about the squatter cities in which he lived. Go to ted.npr.org. We've heard some big ideas about the future of our cities. Now let's take a moment to hear what your cities sound like right now.
The sound of Chicago is a man playing a saxophone under the Michigan Avenue Bridge.
We put out a call to our listeners asking you to send us some iconic sounds from your cities.
The sound of Los Angeles is an immigrant rights march.
The sound of New York City is an a cappella group singing in a subway car.
The sound in my city every morning from Fort Hood, Texas, is the sound of soldiers training.
And the sound of Torino, Italy, is the celebration of a winning game.
The sound of Cape Canaveral, Florida, is a crowd watching a rocket launch.
Here we go.
Stan.
This is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Allison Stewart. On today's show, we're talking about the future of our cities and the power they have to foster community and hope, even in the world's most difficult and dense urban centers. And we're hearing iconic sounds of several cities, which we asked our listeners to share with us. Our next TED speaker says the biggest urban revitalization challenge we face today isn't happening in the big cities.
We've got to celebrate and learn from the energy, the entrepreneurialism, and lower carbon footprints of those compact, heavily populated areas, the megacities, the mega slums. But we really need to recognize that as the planet is becoming more and more urbanized, in many respects, it's actually becoming more and more suburbanized. We've had the last 50 years, we've been building the suburbs with a lot of unintended consequences.
That's Ellen Dunham Jones, a professor of architecture at Georgia Tech in Atlanta. In her 2010 TEDx talk, she said the best way to understand the future of our cities is to rethink the current state of our suburbs.
The big design and development project of the next 50 years is going to be retrofitting suburbia. So whether it's redeveloping...
Ellen Dunham Jones is with me now. And Ellen, just so we have a definition of terms, what does retrofitting suburbia mean?
Retrofitting suburbia is taking some of our least sustainable landscapes, the landscapes of dead malls, dying big box stores, aging commercial strip corridors, office parks, garden apartments, the whole kit and caboodle that is extremely auto-dependent, requires an enormous amount of resources, and in many respects is really pretty wasteful. And now that those properties are aging and underperforming, we have an opportunity to retrofit them into more sustainable places.
You talk a lot about areas and cities that are repurposing dead malls. How do malls die?
Malls die for a lot of reasons, and part of it is simply we've oversaturated the market. You know, they compete with each other, and certainly the internet is also beginning to have just a growing and growing impact on retail stores in general. So the average lifespan of a mall is about 25 to 30 years, and we started building them in earnest in the 70s. So we've got a third of our enclosed regional malls right now are dead or dying, and only about a third that are really strong and healthy.
What can one do with a dead mall?
All sorts of things. I'm constantly surprised at the wide range. So this happens to be a dead mall in St. Louis. It's now home to artist studios, theater groups, dance troupes. It's not pulling in as much tax revenue as it once was, but it's serving its community. It's keeping the lights on. It's, I think, a really great institution. Other malls have been re-inhabited as nursing homes, as universities, and as all variety of office space. We also found a lot of examples of dead big box stores that have been converted into all sorts of community serving uses as well. Lots of schools, lots of churches, and lots of libraries. This one is a little L-shaped strip shopping center in Phoenix, Arizona. Really, all they did was they gave it a fresh coat of bright paint, a gourmet grocery, and they put a restaurant in the old post office. Never underestimate the power of food to turn a place around and make it a destination. It's been so successful, they've now taken over the strip across the street, and the real estate ads in the neighborhood all very proudly proclaim walking distance to La Grande Orange, because it provided its neighborhood with what sociologists like to call a third place. If home is the first place and work is the second place, the third place is where you go to hang out and build community. There's a real hunger for more third places. This is Mashpee Commons, the oldest retrofit that we found, and it's just incrementally, over the last 20 years, built urbanism on top of its parking lots.
In your talk, you have up some slides about Mashpee Commons, and it's very stark, the difference between what it was and what it's become. Can you describe it to the radio audience?
Mashpee Commons was a fairly typical 1960s strip mall on Cape Cod, just surrounded by a sea of parking. And then it was owned by a family, and over the course of 20 years, bit by bit, they just began building on top of the parking lots and creating a little urban grid of walkable blocks with 2 to 3 story buildings with apartments above the shops, and creating a little downtown that Mashpee had never had before. And part of how they make sure that they're going to have local retailers is they deliberately built some of their retail spaces as little liner buildings on the edges of parking lots that are too shallow to work for the national chains, but they're great to incubate local business.
You end your TED Talk with a description of a protest that happened in Silver Spring, Maryland. And it was on a green space made out of AstroTurf.
Now, retrofits are often accused of being examples of faux downtowns and instant urbanism. And not without reason. You don't get much more phony than an AstroTurf town green. And they are public places, but that are managed by private companies. And just the surface appearances are like the AstroTurf here. You know, they make me wince. So, you know, I mean, I'm glad that the urbanism is doing its job. The fact that a protest is happening, really, it does mean that the layout of the blocks, the streets and blocks, the putting in of public space, compromised as it may be, is still a really great thing. But we've got to get the architecture better. I want you to join the protest and start demanding more sustainable suburban places, more sustainable places, period. Culturally, we tend to think that downtowns should be dynamic, and we expect that, but we seem to have an expectation that the suburbs should forever remain frozen in whatever adolescent form they were first given birth to. It's time to let them grow up. So I want you to all support the zoning changes, the road diets, the infrastructure improvements, and the retrofits that are coming soon to a neighborhood near you. Thank you.
Ellen Dunham Jones, thank you so much for being on the TED Radio Hour.
Thank you.
Ellen Dunham Jones is a professor of architecture at Georgia Tech. You can find links to her book, Retrofitting Suburbia, and pictures of many of the sites we discussed. Go to ted.npr.org. Jeffrey West says, we can't make our cities work better until we know how they work.
Cities are the crucible of civilization.
That's West speaking at TED in 2011. He's a physicist who studies the behavior and development of cities. He says the only way to understand the city is to understand its defining patterns and deep structure. These clues will show us whether a city will flourish or fall apart.
Cities are the origins of global warming, impact on the environment, health, pollution, disease, finance, economies, energy, are all problems that are confronted by having cities. That's where all these problems come from. However, cities, despite having this kind of negative aspect to them, are also the solution, because cities are the vacuum cleaners, the magnets that have sucked up creative people, creating ideas, innovation, wealth, and so on.
So when you first sat down and decided what to put into your TED Talk, you only have a limited amount of time, what did you hope people would glean from this talk?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. There were one or two major points I really wanted to get across. One was to emphasize that the truly major seminal role that cities have been playing in not only creating the extraordinary quality and standards of living we have in the developed world, but also being the source of this kind of tsunami of problems. And these problems have been with us for, you know, certainly for 200 years, but that we only feel they're upon us now because we've been accelerating at this exponential rate. So that was one of the major points that I wanted to get across. And the second associated with it was that we form cities in order to enhance interaction, to facilitate growth, wealth creation, ideas, innovation. But in so doing, we create, from a physicist's viewpoint, entropy, meaning all of those bad things that we feel are engulfing us. But to see these as an integrated, more holistic, systemic package. My provocative statement is that we desperately need a serious scientific theory of cities, and scientific theory means quantifiable, relying on underlying generic principles that can be made in a, put into a predictive framework. That's the quest. Is that conceivable? Are there universal kind of laws? So here's two questions that I have in my head when I think about this problem. The first is, are cities kind of part of biology? Is London a great big whale? Is Edinburgh a horse? And if that is the case, how come that it's very hard to kill a city? You could drop an atom bomb on a city, and 30 years later, it's surviving. Very few cities fail.
You and your colleagues set out to find, as you say, a quantifiable, serious scientific theory of cities, one that relies on underlying generic principles. How do you start to do that? What are the immediate questions that need to be tackled?
We have to look across the multitude of urban systems and ask, is there in fact any evidence of regularities, of some commonality that, for example, in the United States extends from, New York down to here I am in Santa Fe? Are there commonalities among them? And are those commonalities shared by Tokyo and London and other cities across the planet? So the first strategy in this is to ask, does the data show any regularities that would be suggestive that underlying what appears to be kind of this random growth and this random agglomeration of buildings and people and roads and factories and so forth, is there in fact underlying that a kind of regularity? Is there a structure? Has there been operating a bunch of effective emergent rules that have been hidden? And despite the history, geography, culture, and the efforts of politicians and urban planners in specific places at specific times, are the things that transcend that, because that's the way science works. Science works by looking for regularities and then asking what, if any, are the underlying principles that are driving or constraining those regularities. So that was the kind of paradigm that we used to start to think about this. And one of the most successful of those paradigms that has been used many times in science is something called scaling. And that simply asks the question, you know, if you take a physical system of a given size, what happens if I scale it up? Can I understand the dynamics and the change in organization as I scale it up?
So is London a scaled up Birmingham, which is a scaled up Brighton, et cetera, et cetera? New York has scaled up San Francisco, which is a scaled up Santa Fe. They are networks. And the most important network of cities is you. Cities are just a physical manifestation of your interactions, our interactions, and the clustering and grouping of individuals. And here's scaling of cities. This shows that in this very simple example, which happens to be a mundane example of number of petrol stations as a function of size, you see exactly the same kind of thing. There is a scaling, that is that the number of petrol stations in a city is now given to you when you tell me its size. But here's what's surprising. It scales in the same way everywhere. This is just European countries, but you do it in Japan or China or Colombia. Always the same, with the same kind of economy of scale to the same degree, and any infrastructure you look at, whether it's the length of roads, length of electrical lines, anything you look at
has the same economy of scale, scaling in the same way. It's an integrated system that has evolved despite all the planning and so on. And what you see is the bigger you are, the more you have per capita. Higher wages, more super creative people per capita as you get bigger, more patents per capita, more crime per capita, and we've looked at everything, more AIDS cases, flu, etc. This, no doubt, is the reason why a million people a week are gathering in cities, because they think that all those wonderful things like creative people, wealth, income, is what attracts them, forgetting about the ugly and the bad.
This is a simple question, but I'm sure it's one that a lot of listeners have, and people have asked you this. How can there be these universal laws when you have so many different cultures and so many different kind of people around the world?
Yes. Here's what's really extraordinary, I think. When you look at a city, you know, it looks so unique. You feel this kind of uniqueness, you know, and especially if you go from a big city to a small city, or if you go from one country to another, cities look very different. Often they even feel very different. You know, and they are, of course. They certainly are. But it turns out those differences that we feel actually only represent maybe 10 to 20% of what's actually going on in the city and what the city really is. You know, and that's expressed by these scaling laws, these extraordinary regularities that go from the smallest towns to the biggest cities, and they have the same scaling no matter where you are in the world and no matter what metric you look at. So the question is, just as you said, where in the hell does that come from? Why? How can that be? What is it that is common across all socioeconomic metrics, but is also common across the world independent of culture? Well, the commonality that transcends all cities, no matter where they are and no matter what size, is, and I know this sounds like a platitude, it's because cities are actually places where people live. And the socioeconomic behavior of people is, roughly speaking, universal. That is, the way we interact as social beings is not so different whether you're in the United States, Europe, Japan, China, or Latin America. And so this is some universal kind of phenomenon that is hardwired in and has evolved as we evolved as human beings and as we evolved particularly as social human beings. And so it is that the kinds of networks, the hierarchical networks that comprise societies, despite some of the differences in culture, have many of the similar kinds of regularities like that that transcend where you are. And we believe, and this is a hypothesis, that it is that universality of social networks and the kinds of structures of those social networks that are being manifested in the structure of cities and manifested, therefore, in these scaling laws, because ultimately cities are there to facilitate interaction between people, bringing people closer together to interact, create ideas, innovate. And all of those come from the same kind of social interactions. So that's the universality.
Jeffrey West from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you for taking the time to be on the TED Radio Hour.
Sure, it's a great pleasure.
Jeffrey West. You can find more of his research about the science of cities on our website, ted.npr.org. Our program is produced by Jeff Rogers, Sam Greenspan, and Megan Kane. Special thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Janet Lee, Emily McManus, and Darren Triff. Also thanks to NPR's Eric Newsom. And thanks to all of you,
Dennis Conroe,
Stephanie Fu,
Marcus Burns,
Chelsea Christensen,
Will Coley,
Callie Burke,
who sent us sounds of your cities. I'm Allison Stewart. You've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.